Hello, it's Monday, February the 15th. This is Andrew Pearce. This is the Andrew Pearce Show coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, I'll be talking to a model who was first scouted at the age of 15 and is worried sick her own daughters may join the industry. We'll be talking also, it's 50 years since decimalisation. Do you remember it when it came in? Can you remember pounds, shillings and pence? Harry and Meghan having a baby, and they've announced it in their usual way in a very moody, atmospheric black and white photograph. Didn't they say they didn't want any publicity? But first, we're going to get more details next week, of course, on how to lift the lockdown. Pub owners are saying the idea that they may not be back in business until May is simply not good enough, and thousands could go out of business. All sorts of leaks coming out of government seem to suggest that hospitality firms, pubs, may be able to serve customers outside by Easter, which falls on the weekend of April the 2nd, but with a full reopening not expected until May at the earliest. Some pub owners have warned the government that those plans for reopening could mean many of them will never reopen and will go ultimately bust. I'm joined now by Tim Foster, who's the owner of Yummy Pubs. Tim, how bleak is it for you if your pubs aren't allowed to reopen in full till sometime in May?
As bleak as it was when we last spoke, to be honest. So, yeah, our cash flow is still predicting that we run out of money by the end of March. So we need to get trading for the end of March, and we need to have be able to be trading in full. As we've spoken about before, I've got a pub with a huge outdoor space that looks over a 26-acre lake. So that one, can I trade it just outside? Absolutely. Would I? Absolutely. Just take off the shackles and let me go, and I'll be trading it. But my other three simply wouldn't be viable. Just wouldn't be able to open them and trade it. So it's a crazy idea that's not based on any form of science, again, not based on any form of facts, again, not based on any form of evidence, again. We're just being used as a political football, as we have done throughout this entire pandemic. So to not open us up at the same time as non-essential retail, I want somebody to tell me why, to be honest. I want somebody to give me a report and let me know why, because it's already been proven that we were the best in the world when we reopened and our COVID secure measures put in place. So I'd really just like the speculation to continue. It's fine. It gets us talking about it. It gets people talking and remembering that we're still out here and we're closed and we're forced to be doing different things, which we are. But we are running out of cash. The government grants are landing now. We've had to chase them. We've spent weeks and weeks and weeks chasing money that wasn't paid to us back from November. And so have so many other people in our sector, but that money is beginning to land, so we're getting it, but it still doesn't cover my bills. So every day I stay closed, I just lose money, and I'm losing money at a phenomenal rate, and I need to get open, I need to get trading, and using us as, political football and putting us on front pages of everything to get the nation back into hoping that they can get into the local. We experienced this back in sort of April, May last year when everybody was saying, or the front page of the Sun, head to the pub garden for a beer this weekend. So we have to wait until what he says next week, I think, and play a game. But if they're looking through, as we've been led to believe this morning by Matt Hancock and all of his interviews, that they're looking at the evidence this week to make decisions next week, then I'll just implore them to look at that and actually look at evidence and look at facts and studies rather than just making this stuff up.
We get the sort of route map from the Prime Minister next week, Tim, but also we'll have a budget in the first week in March. Are you hoping there may be some more financial support announced for the hospitality industry?
There's got to be. There just simply has to be. So we need a stimulus to help us trade out of this, and we helped this country come out of the last recession. We can be the ones to help it again, because it's not just us. We'll be there to facilitate it, the consumer. You know, the people of this country are desperate to socialise again. They're desperate to get out. They've been starved of it now for coming to over a year. We can be there and help it, but we need the stimulus. We need the VAT reduction to remain in place. We need the business rates. Again, we were having this conversation last time. It's great not having to pay business rates, but my businesses have been closed more of this year than they've been open. So I shouldn't have been paying them in the first place. So to continuously say, that we've been given supporting business rates is actually now beginning to be a bit grating, where they need to start saying we've come up with new plans, new measures. And that's what I'm expecting the Chancellor to do when he stands up. He's proven in his report that was commissioned by the Treasury that he's had to help out wasn't responsible for the second spike. So he now needs to believe in us like he did before and give us the support to reopen. And we just implore him to continuously think about who he's going to be helping, because we can help this nation come out of it. And it's not me. I speak on behalf of the smaller operators that don't get the opportunity to talk to people like you. And it's them that we have to worry about, because there are vultures circling. You know, there are some big money boys coming to the market to pick up distressed assets. So when people keep on saying the pub won't survive, that's rubbish. The pub will always be here, but it'll be under a different guise. And if you want it to be operated and run by people who care passionately about the building and the people in it, they're the independent operators. And at the moment, those people are the people that have been put under serious, serious pressure by not getting the support. And they are the lifeblood of our industry. They're the reason that people move into the sector, and they need to be protected. So he just needs to stimulus, give us the opportunity to run at it. Just don't put these restrictions on us that we had last time. You and I sitting in a pub with a scotched egg was funny for the front page of a newspaper. It was soul destroying for the 3 million people we employ.
Just finally, Tim, maybe you should invite Sir Patrick Vallance and Chris Whitty, the Chief Scientific Officer and Chief Medical Officer, to your nice pub for a pint and show them, so they can see for themselves how COVID-friendly most pubs in Britain have become.
Day or night, any time of the day, any day they want, any notice they want to give me, whether it's 5 minutes or 5 hours, they can come here. And I'll show them, and I'll be very respectful, and I'll bite my teeth, and I'll show them everything that we're doing. Yeah. And they may not want to drink alcohol. They may just want a cup of tea. But believe it or not, we'll sell as much tea and coffee pretty much as we sell of alcohol as well, because people come here to meet one another, meet friends, enjoy each other's company. They do not come here to get absolutely blottoed and put pressure on the NHS. So yes, they are more than welcome, as are you, my friend, to come down.
Well, I tell you, I'm going to find your nice pub with all the acres of land and the lake, and I'm going to come and have a pint with you. And I won't be drinking tea, by the way. I will not be drinking tea.
You're more than welcome, whenever you want.
I look forward to it. All right, that's Tim Foster, who is, of course, the owner of Yummy Pubs, talking about what happens next. Why don't you visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and video series. And remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. The Duke and Duchess of Sussex are expecting their second child, and as ever, announced it in their own very unique way. They shared a black and white picture of themselves under a tree, with Harry resting his hand on Meghan's head as she cradles her bump. Our star columnist, Sarah Vine, describes the couple as uber influences and says the image is extraordinarily intimate, and she joins me now. They do things their own way, Sarah, and that photograph was, of course, very striking on very many front pages today, I would think, around the world, actually.
Yes, I think that it just reminded me of that scene in Notting Hill where, you know, Hugh Grant is lying on the bench and, you know, Julia Roberts is resting her head on his lap and she's pregnant. It's like it's sort of straight out of a sort of Hollywood movie. I think what's interesting about Harry and Meghan is that whenever they release these photographs, there's never any eye contact with the viewer. It's always a sort of intimate portrait of them together, lost in their own kind of world. It's very interesting. It's a sort of odd kind of combination of wanting to, bring in the viewer, but also sort of slightly keeping you at arm's length and making it very clear that, you know, this is not about you, it's about them.
Yeah, I wonder how much we'll see of this child. Of course, who will make a little bit of history, because it'll be the Queen's first great grandchild born in the States.
I know. Do you think if it's a girl, they'll call it Diana?
Well, there's a lot of talk about that on the internet. I think certainly Diana will be in the name, if not the first name, it'll be the second name.
Yeah,
they might call Elizabeth to try and grovel to the Queen, because they're in such bad odour with Her Majesty.
I think it's nice for Archie, because Archie's on his own and he's away from all his cousins and his family. So I think it would be nice for him to have a brother or sister. I don't know. I mean, I imagine they'll do what they always do, which is that they'll say that they don't want anybody prying into their private life. And then they'll just, you know, just open the door
to Netflix.
People that, I mean, it is with them. It is, you know, this whole sort of privacy argument is it's very much a one-way street. You know, they don't, they claim to want their privacy, but then they do things like this, you know, and that is a kind of paradox, because if you really wanted your privacy, you wouldn't release photographs, very intimate photographs of you sort of frolicking in a glade in California. I mean, the other thing about this is I do think it's a tiny bit insensitive, not insensitive, but in the sense that they clearly don't really, I mean, there's sort of a bit of a tin ear there. I mean, Britain is, you know, locked down in February, freezing cold, everyone's having a miserable time. You know, it would be, they could have done it in a slightly less kind of, oh, look at us and our marvellous life kind of way. But that's what I meant when I said they're uber influencers. I mean, they have that influencer vibe about them, which is that they think that, you know, what they do is so intrinsically fascinating and interesting that people will just want to look at it. And I guess they're probably right. I mean, clearly they are, because obviously why would Netflix pay them all that money, et cetera, et cetera. But it is that there's a sort of parallel there with all those influencers sitting in Dubai drinking cocktails and sitting around in bikinis. Going, oh, look at us, aren't we fabulous? Here's my bicep. And it's just the same kind of vibe, yeah, if you ask me.
And, of course, they've got to put themselves out there, because they're going to get paid so much money by Netflix and Spotify and all the other media outlets that they need them to have a high profile. So, and hence we'll get more photographs. We'll get, I suppose there'll be another photograph of the holding a bump.
Yes, and, you know, we'll all be obliged to print it and write about it and praise it and say how marvellous it is. Whilst at the same time slightly feeling perhaps that, you know, these people are having their cake and eating it. But maybe, you know, good for them. They certainly manoeuvred themselves into a very, you know, privileged, nice position where they have all the sort of upside of being royals and famous, but appears none of the downsides. So,
Not for them unveiling a plaque in Milton Keynes on a wet February afternoon.
Exactly. You know,
which is the life of Prince William and the Duchess of Cambridge.
Yes. But I don't know. I mean, I think, no, not in the slightest. I think the world is basically divided into two camps. Those who think that they are, you know, amazing and wonderful and fabulous and that they can do nothing wrong. And then the old cynics like you and me who take a slightly different view. I mean, you know, each to each. But it's nice for them that they're having a baby, especially, you know, after she had a miscarriage last year. And it's, you know, obviously one wishes them every happiness. I just wish they would be a little bit less, the word is self-obsessed about it all.
You know. Yeah, absolutely. That's Sarah Vine. Read her column every Wednesday, of course, in the Daily Mail, and she's often in the paper on other days too. Now, if you enjoy the Andrew Pearce Show, I hope you do. Why don't you subscribe to us? Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Google or Spotify, and get in touch by tweeting us at Mel Plus or me at Tory Boy Pearce. It was a time of change like never before, but 50 years ago, Britain converted to a decimal currency. On February the 15th, 1971, Edward Heath's government formally abolished pounds, shillings and pence. The transition began 5 years earlier, but it was the most drastic overhaul in British money since the pound was introduced in Anglo-Saxon England as early as 775 AD. I'm joined now by Alexandra Siddons, who's content executive at coin collecting site Change Checker. Alexandra, I suspect you were not even born 50 years ago, but it was a huge, massive shake-up.
Well, you're right there. Yeah, I wasn't. I was actually born in 96, so quite a while before my time. But it's such an interesting story, isn't it? And I think from Change Checker myself, it carries such an interesting story to the decimal coins that we have and love today. But, you know, like you say, it's such a big anniversary because these coins, the pre-decimal coins that we had before, you know, 12 pennies to the shilling and 20 shillings to the pound, this old system dated back to Roman times, like you say. So it's a huge change to our UK currency. It's a really big anniversary to be celebrating today on its 50th year.
And it's interesting as we talk about decimalisation, because more and more since we've been involved in this wretched lockdown, Alexandra, more and more shops now aren't taking cash because they think it's going to be more COVID friendly if people swipe their card and nobody, no hands. I mean, do you worry about whether cash is going to disappear?
I don't think so. I think Britain is a country that has always loved its coins and its cash. You know, we've had our decimal coins now from 1971, and we just love them, and we keep seeing new inventions of them. Of course, we saw the round pounds be re-specified, and we got a whole new design to our obviously 12-sided £1 coin that we see today. We've seen commemorative 10p coins in the last sort of 3 years, so I don't have any major concerns at all. Obviously, it's uncertain times at the moment. I think for change collecting, it's been particularly hard because we can't exchange coins in the same way that we used to, which is such a shame. But and fingers crossed, everything will go back to normal and we'll see our coins sort of circulating a bit more again.
Do any other countries around the world, I mean, I've travelled extensively, but I can't, I mean, do many other countries have a decimal system?
Yeah, I would say the majority really follow a decimal system of sorts. I think definitely England was one of the later ones to actually move across to a decimal system. So we were kind of a little bit late to the game. But yeah, I would say there is a form of decimal currency sort of all around the world. There's only a few minor countries that perhaps don't, you know, adopt this system now and refer to what we would call as an old system, where it's not in a metric conversion.
And do you see, I mean, I wonder too, if with the drive to be green, if we start to phase out notes and have more coins, can you see that happening? A £5 coin, a £10 coin even?
I don't think so. We did have our £5 coins that were introduced initially as crowns. Obviously, the crown was then remonetized to a £5 coin. So we've seen the sort of phase out of £5 coins and the introduction of our polymer £5 and £10 and £20 notes. And these have been so popular, and obviously we see some incredible people from history celebrated on them. And I think the move to the polymer banknote, which is more sturdy, it's more reliable, and therefore, you know, we need to produce less of them because they don't get as damaged. I really don't see the banknotes really disappearing. I can see them sort of staying in our currency for a long time yet.
What's your favourite coin in circulation? I forgot a thing about £2 coins. I don't know
why. Have you?
Yeah, I collect. They build up in a jar, and when the jar's full up, I take them to the building site. You look horrified, of course. Do you think lots of people have a favourite coin, or is it just I'm a bit weird?
No, I definitely think people have a favourite coin. You know, coin collecting as a hobby, I really do think has kind of seen a resurgence in recent years. We've seen a lot more character 50p's. So we've seen the Beatrix Potter coins. We've also seen £2 coins celebrating authors. So I think it really has brought about a new generation of collectors, and a lot of younger collectors, a lot of family collectors too. So I do think people do have a favourite. Mine would actually probably be the Charles Dickens £2. It's my favourite, and it was issued in 2012 to commemorate the 200th anniversary of his birth. I love it because I come from an English literature degree background. So obviously coming from that side of things, I love it. But that's the great thing about coin collecting. You learn things through the coins that you find in your change. But have you got a favourite? You said that you collect some.
I was never a Dickens fan, so I'm trying to think. I think they brought out some coins, didn't they, for London 2012?
Yeah,
and I kept some of those because I was a great sceptic about the Olympic Games coming to Britain. I thought the whole thing would be a shambles and a catastrophe. And of course, they were a magnificent event. So I've still got my 2012 coins in a box somewhere collecting dust.
Well, they're really popular. So it's been estimated now that over 75% of those have been withdrawn from circulation by collectors keeping them for themselves. So I'll assume you're part of that community.
Yeah, I must be part of that community. Isn't that interesting? So you don't think we're going to have, in 50 years' time, they're going to put old grannies and granddads through hell again and change the system? Because I can remember having to help my grandfather with decimalisation. And I just keep pointing out to him, Grandad, it's a lot easier. It's so much easier. But of course, he'd been used to pounds, shillings and pence for 70 years.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I can't really comment on the future. You know, like we've seen so much change in the past 50 years anyway. You know, I'm not really one to comment on what might come. But like you say, that changeover back in 1971 was so big, and it was obviously bound to be met with some hesitation. You know, my grandparents are the same. They still to this day are convinced that old money was the better form of currency. But it's because it hadn't been changed in centuries. So I think, you know, the elders in society perhaps did struggle a little bit more because they had spent their whole lives using old money. But I think in general, the population really did embrace the change because it did inevitably run without a hitch. So, yeah, I think it did really well.
It did. That's Alexandra Siddons, who's content executive at coin collecting site Change Checker. Thanks for joining us. Deputy sports editor Matt Gatwood's here, and I'm afraid to say the cricket's going horribly wrong, Matt, isn't it, up in India?
It is, yes. England are right behind the eight ball. I mean, basically, they will lose tomorrow morning because they've been set, nominally 400-odd to win the Test match, which they won't do. And they've already lost wickets in the second innings, so overnight. They always knew it was going to be difficult once they subsided to 130 out in the first innings. And today, the Indians had a bit of fun at England's expense, really. I mean, Ashwin, who's their number eight batsman, so basically one of their bowlers, their main spin bowler, smashed England for a remarkable 100. And this is when there's been a lot of complaints going around about the quality of the pitch and everyone saying that the pitch isn't good enough for Test cricket. Well, Ashwin showed that it is good enough if you apply yourself and you have a little bit of luck along the way, you can get runs on it. So England have got a massive uphill struggle to get anything but pride now out of this game. So it will be 1-1 going into the third Test. So, it's a shame because it does feel like they've kind of, from the highs of the first Test win to the lows of this one, it's going to be a record defeat in this Test, you'd have thought. It shows how quickly you can come crashing back to earth.
Absolutely. And Manchester United, they've lost ground in the title race. And yet another row, Matt, about, is it called VAR? V-A-R? Harry Maguire was thought they were going to get a penalty, but wasn't he offside? So how could they get a penalty?
Well, actually, it's such a bizarre rule. I mean, it's so hard. The managers didn't even know the laws of the game yesterday in this instance, because he could have been given the penalty, even though he was offside, ridiculously, because unless he is within reach of the ball, he is not active in terms of being considered to be offside. So if he was pushed over, even though he was in an offside position, the penalty would be given, and it was only when the ball gets near to him that he can be flagged offside. So ridiculously, he could have been given, but it wasn't. The referee originally gave it, then he went to look at the VAR screen, then he decided, well, Harry Maguire had dived. Harry Maguire was angry about it after, saying, well, definitely a penalty, but most neutral observers didn't seem to think they'd been massively denied or robbed of that decision. Manchester United, Graham Souness, said that it was a dive on TV. Our own refereeing expert, Mark Clattenburg, said that he didn't think it was a great injustice either. So I think United need to look a little bit closer to home for their inability to beat a West Brom side who are adrift in the bottom three. They need to sort of point the fingers at themselves rather than at the refereeing.
It's all gone a bit pear-shaped for them, a bit like Liverpool. They were on a great run, winning game after game, and now they've come a bit unstuck.
It's really weird this season, because it was about a month ago. Man U were playing Liverpool about a month ago, and we were all billing it as this sort of title-defining match between the two teams at the top of the league. That was ignoring somewhat Man City, who had a couple of games in hand. But since that point, United and Liverpool have been in an absolute tailspin and have barely picked up a point. Man City have beaten everyone who's come near them, and Man City now, as you know, are clear at the top, and you know everyone's got them odds on to win the title. So, yeah, it's been a dramatic shift in fortunes over the last sort of 3 or 4 weeks.
All right, and just finally, a Johnny May wonder try. Who does he play for, Matt?
So Johnny May, England's winger, who Italy were beaten by England at the weekend at Twickenham as Eddie Jones's side got sort of back on track after that embarrassing and appalling performance against Scotland. And if you haven't seen the Johnny May try, you really must see it. It was a wonderful feat of athleticism as he jumped sort of up in the air over the defender, managed to twist his body as he was sort of looked like he was going to go out of touch and land and touch the ball down before his feet landed out of bounds. So it was a most remarkable try, worth seeing. I'd love to see if you could replicate it. It was really a wonderful effort by Johnny May. And that's what England fans want to see. They want to see these wingers with the ball in hand, not this kicking game that England have been so insistent upon, but they want to see the wingers with the ball in hand doing these clever and special things that make rugby so thrilling to watch, rather than kicking the ball up in the air. It's what we're crying out for, isn't it?
Certainly is. And when I've watched the try, Matt, I'll give it a try and see if I can replicate it. But
okay, and then I'll visit you in hospital.
Yes, exactly. I'll have either broken my neck or broken something.
That is
the ever cheerful deputy sports editor Matt Gatwood. Now, if you want to get in touch, you can tweet us at Mel Plus or me at Tory Boy Pierce. A model who was scouted at the tender age of just 15 says she'd be pretty reluctant to allow her own daughters to follow her into the industry. Claire Boyd says, of course, the job was glamorous and exciting, but it put her in compromising positions and even danger. She's written a terrific piece in the Mail about it today, and she joins me now. Claire, I was struck by how you were first scouted. You were in a cafe with a couple of mates. You didn't think you were pretty, but you didn't. And a couple of women passing gave you their card. Come and join our modelling agency. It took you 2 years to pluck up the courage, but no regrets once you'd done so.
I don't have regrets about the many positive experiences I had as a model. I travelled the world very young, met an amazing crew of people, some of whom still great friends. I met my husband, but I would say my main message of the article is that what I wished had been different would have been the regulations and chaperoning and protections in place for someone my age. And actually, my bookers were wonderful women. They were very kind, and they would often call themselves our second mothers. And I loved the idea of that. But in theory, it's fine. In practice, it doesn't really work because inevitably on a shoot, you're not necessarily, you can be changing in front of people are walking through. It's a very sort of fluid and creative and energetic environment to work in. And inevitably, if you don't have people there to look after you very specifically and strictly, then inevitably, you're put at risk, as any child would be in any situation that young working.
I mean, you've written about this in your book, The Pretty One, and you talk about predatory photographers. Do you think they're the same today? Have times changed with Me Too and all that? I mean, what's your hunch?
I think my feeling is times are changing, and I feel very positive speaking to agents who work with young girls today who are passionately involved in changing those regulations and those safeguarding measures, and even using the words like safeguarding. So I really have optimism that things are changing, but I don't think they've changed enough. My feeling is that really, as in America, actually, you're not allowed to work under 18. I mean, I feel that should be a worldwide thing for all fashion models. And that's what I feel quite passionately about. And in my book, I explore that. I mean, it's also all about sort of all the other pitfalls of it, so it's eating disorders and the sort of jealousies and sibling jealousies that come into my main character's life. But I think that actually I feel very strongly that girls under 18 are too young to work for adult clothing lines, adult perfumes. And a lot of them don't employ them now. That's what's changing. The industry is changing. I really do believe that. But I think it's slow. And I think as much awareness as possible, really, is what I believe in for young girls who are working in the industry now or who are aspiring young models.
Again, in the article, you talk about how some girls were put under huge pressure to sleep with maybe the head of a fashion house or something, and they feared if they didn't do so, that the work would dry up. Was that a pressure that you lived under too? You recognise that in your own life, presumably?
Well, I wouldn't say it was a pressure from, say, agents, that it wasn't talked about. It wasn't something that was a sort of open thing, but it was, I mean, I suppose in all industries there is an element of power and sex working together. I mean, inevitably that is relevant to all industries, and the Me Too movement highlighted that sadly. But I think when you're dealing with girls who are that young, who are that much more vulnerable, then those pressures, which are normalised, but the idea that you are, you're in a situation where someone is approaching you or making sexual advances, and you might fear that if you don't sort of go along with it, in any kind of coercive, abusive situation, it's very easy to sort of feel embarrassed to say, please, that's wrong, or I don't want to do that, or that feels awkward, or to storm off a set, or all these things. So I would say that I felt that was very real in certain awkward situations. I might have been in, as I described in my article. But it wasn't really talked about. I think a lot of these problems were normalized, and I think that's also something that Me Too, you know, in terms of the sort of average everyday sexism that all women experience in the Me Too that have been highlighted in the Me Too movement. I think that is particularly difficult for very young girls in those situations where you are having to wear certain clothes, you're having to sort of put forward a certain amount of your sexuality forward, and that's what I feel makes them particularly vulnerable.
And I was fascinated that in America, models, they're not allowed to work till they're 18 or over, but in Britain, 16 to 18, unchaperoned. Yeah. And as you make the point, that's their children, effectively.
Their children, exactly.
Yeah. And do you think that there should be a rule, the rule should be changed to ensure that at the very least, if they are going to work at 16, they should be chaperoned?
Yes, absolutely, 100%. I feel very strongly about it. I just think you're too young under 18. I think once you're an adult, and I don't really understand why it isn't in place already. I find that odd, that it's taking this long for that to happen. I think it will. And as I say, I really do believe there are so many people in the industry who really are now aware that there is a sort of gap there. And I think, I really hope that that will change soon. I'm sure it will. But at the moment, there are lots of girls working who are terribly young. And there are lots of people, men mostly, who are taking advantage of that. And that makes me frightened for some girls who might, you know, not have a good parent, or not even a good parent, an aware parent, a parent who isn't naive about the industry. And that's the other thing. I think more awareness there is, the more likely a mother is to step in and be very much part of that child's life.
Where we started the conversation about your daughters, you would not want your daughters modelling any time before the age of 18. When they're over 18, of course, they're adults. They can do what they will.
Exactly. And I feel that they can make then an informed decision based on what they know from me. And I would want them to be going in with their eyes open and to understand fully where the potential dangers are. It would be an absolute no from me before they were 18.
All right, that's Claire Boyd. She's written a fantastic piece in the paper today about dreading the idea of her teenage daughters following her into the ugly world of modelling. And she's got that book. It's called The Pretty One. Well, that's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.